Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we know from our news, human-induced climate change is posing an ever greater threat to our future. This hour, Iowa perspectives on what can be done. We have three guests. We'll look at the impacts climate change is already having in the state and the actions that are being taken a little later in the hour. How temperature change may mean Iowa's historic prairie plants will be unable to inhabit the future climate. Think about that. Historic prairie plants that have been around for how long? Unable to inhabit our future climate in Iowa. Also, we'll talk about how to curb flooding caused by the extreme weather events that are predicted and we are already experiencing. But first, in this first half hour, carbon sequestration. Let's talk with Jill Yukin. She is a longtime farmer near Atlantic, Iowa, in the southwest part of the state. Also retired deputy director of the Iowa Bioeconomy Institute. Jill Yukin, welcome to our program.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
Let's start off, before we get into carbon sequestration and what that may promise for the present and the future, tell us a little bit about your background and your farm near Atlantic in Cass County in southwest Iowa.
Sure. Well, our base operation is on a farm that was a century farm in 2012. So it's been in my family since 1912 when my great-grandfather purchased it. So we're definitely a family farming operation with a lot of history in some of the acres that we farm. My husband and I have farmed for 41 years. And our daughter and son-in-law have started working into the operation for the last 3 years. So we're very blessed to have a family member and her husband that wants to take over the operation. We're mm-hmm. excited about that.
Okay, many decades of farming. Tell us a little bit about the type of farming you've done on your land there.
Mm-hmm. So like most people in Iowa, we grow corn and soybeans. More typical of the southern part of the state, we also have a beef operation. So we tried to keep our, what we would call our highly erodible lands, which we do have in parts of the state of Iowa, in grass. So we have 200 cows that are out on pastures during the summer. And then we also have 150 acres of alfalfa that we harvest usually four times a year to provide the feed for the livestock operation during the winter months. We also have a beef feedlot operation where we feed out the calves that are born in our pastures from our cows, and also purchase cattle from neighbors and also from out of state. So we try to turn our lots twice a year. We use local cattle when we fill the lots in September, and then we buy usually out-of-state cattle when we fill in the spring, and like in May and June.
A lot going on. Very busy you've been by that description. You have lived in your community. You said farming for over 40 years, but you've lived in your community for, I understand, nearly seven decades there in southwest Iowa. I want to hear your observations, Jill, in the time that you've been living there, farming. How would you say you've noticed climate change, that things aren't the way they used to be in more just than this year was bad, this year was good? Can you tell in that period of time any trends that you would say are identifiable?
Sure. Well, as a child, I remember drought periods. I remember my father actually switched from growing corn to growing sorghum for a few years because we had extended periods of drought in Iowa, even back in the 60s and 70s. What has changed is that we didn't used to have major, and I mean 4 to 5 inch rains when I was a kid. We'd have 2 inch rains, but not 4 inches or 5 inches. And so that is one of the predictions that climate scientists have been predicting for a number of years would happen in the Midwest, and it is certainly something that we have noticed. So it's not uncommon these days to get major downpours of extreme rain events that really challenge our conservation practices and our infrastructure. So we actually have a program in Southwest Iowa called Hungry Canyons, and it's basically a term that describes our stream beds and how they wash away where bridges are. And the program that's been put in place to try to stabilize those stream banks so that our bridges can last longer. So definitely we've noticed changes in rain events as a major change.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a little bit about, but not being farmers, most of us listening here, when you get 5 inches as opposed to 2 inches in a downpour, in a weather event, what kind of havoc does that cause on for your agricultural operation?
Sure. Well, and unfortunately, these major rain events tend to happen in the spring. So the challenges that it creates on the farm are that's when we want to be in the field planting our corn and soybeans. So it has actually narrowed the number of, or decreased the number of days that are suitable for planting crops in the spring. And that is a challenge because, and farmers have adapted to that by buying bigger planters and bigger tractors so that they can cover more acres on those days when it is fit. So that is a challenge. The other major challenge is having conservation practices on your landscape that can hold up to these extreme rain events. So, you know, we in Western Iowa, we see more terraces going up. We see the need for grass waterways that can channel that water down to the streams. We see the need for buffer strips that can keep that rainwater that often carries nutrients with it out of the stream. So if you can picture a strip of grass along a stream or river, mm-hmm. that can sort of slow down the water as it's running off from a big rain event and absorb that so that that doesn't go into the streams, especially the nutrient part. So, you know, we've had to implement more practices and make the practices more robust in order so the terraces get bigger, the waterways get bigger. We've also had to put in more tile because one of the greatest drags on yield is wet soil for young crops. So we don't want our soils to be saturated in the springtime because that's not good for germination and for the crops being healthy. So we have put a lot more tile into our farms so that it can drain the water away when we have these major rain events.
Mm-hmm. And these are actual, right, just to make sure, because again, most of us are not agricultural experts as you are, tiles are underground and they will remove excess water into streams that eventually head into rivers.
That's correct. So most places in Iowa, these tile lines are like 6 or 8 inch black plastic pipes that have holes in them. And those tiles are buried 6 foot underground. And so that the water can percolate down to those tile lines, go through those little holes in the side of the tiles, and then be channeled down to the streams or into the waterways. So it's a way to prevent water from sitting on top of the land and to dry out the land quicker, especially in the springtime when we need to get into plant.
For those who've just joined us, my guest this half hour, Jill Yukin, farmer near Atlantic, Iowa, as you've heard, for many decades. Let's talk a little bit about carbon sequestration, the initiatives, the practices you're engaging in that are hopefully helping toward climate change, perhaps models for others. I mentioned at the outset, you're retired deputy director for the Iowa Bioeconomy Institute. In starting to talk about this, where should we start, Jill, in talking about carbon sequestration? For instance, when did it enter your life? When did you learn about it and see the need for it?
Well, as deputy director of the Bioeconomy Institute, our primary purpose was to come up with recyclable sources of carbon to replace petroleum and other fossil fuels. So, you know, we've been looking at how do we use renewable, grow and process and use renewable carbon in our society rather than what I call old carbon that's been buried underground for millennia. Mm-hmm. So we certainly have worked on that for a long time. And as we looked at all of these climate reports, that just made it more important that we not only look at renewable sources of carbon, but that we look at strategies to remove carbon from the atmosphere, because that's the major problem, right? We've used all these fossil fuels all these years and put old carbon up into the atmosphere, and it's there's so much of it there now that we need to draw down what I call suck up carbon from
right.
the atmosphere. So
right. So
the
that's
good
what
news
se-
is,
yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to make sure we understood carbon sequestration. It's a big, long word, fairly new to most people's vocabulary. This is the sequestration of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We're wanting to get it out of the atmosphere to slow or reverse this atmospheric CO2 pollution, to mitigate, perhaps help reverse climate change. So what do we do on the farm with that goal?
Yes. So there's really two different things that we're looking at on the farm. So the first one is trying to have an extended growing season. When climate scientists look at the state of Iowa now, when you've got all of this green stuff growing out on the landscape, we are sucking carbon out of the atmosphere like crazy. They actually see on their maps just this huge sink for carbon. But the problem is when you get to October after frost or April before we have a crop planted, and there's very little growing on the landscape historically, so that we're not pulling carbon out of the atmosphere to any great extent in those seasons. So the things that we've started implementing in Iowa are, number one, cover crops. So when we plant a cover crop, it's usually we can fly it on now, or even there are machines now that can seed cover crops in tall standing corn. So you try to plant the cover crops this time of year so that they can start growing. And once you harvest a field, they really get a lot of sunlight and they can grow to provide cover and continue this sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere for an extended number of months in our climate. Mm-hmm. So that is one strategy that not only shows benefits for sucking carbon out of the air, but huge benefits for water quality, which is another issue that we have in Iowa. So that is a practice that is being rewarded in carbon markets. So farmers can actually, there are a number of programs that farmers can subscribe to where if you adopt the practice of cover crops, you can receive a carbon payment in the marketplace. So there are companies that have developed these programs that will pay you to do that.
Right, because our companies, it is a good look, so to speak, for a company to be carbon neutral or to be helping battle climate change, right? So if they can say they are, you know, carbon neutral by buying, by paying farmers to do this, that's the way it works in this market?
Yes. So there are actually these brokerage firms that cut deals between farmers to do these practices and companies that have made those types of promises. So they're called carbon offset markets. And so a company can offset their carbon emissions by arranging for a farmer to do these kinds of practices on their farms.
Mm-hmm. Cover crops, are there any other additional practices that suck that carbon out of the atmosphere on the farm?
So not necessarily one that sucks carbon out, but one that doesn't put additional carbon into the atmosphere. So when you picture our soils in Iowa, when we were settled a couple centuries ago, our carbon resource in our soil was about 6% or something on a statewide average around 6%. When you till soil, you release carbon into the atmosphere. So when you drive around and you see fields that have been plowed or disced or chisel plowed, when that practice was done, it sent carbon up into the atmosphere. Now, that's carbon that was previously sucked out of the atmosphere, right, by the corn or the soybeans that grew there that year. But if you till it, some of that carbon that was put into the soil goes back up into the atmosphere rather than staying in the soil. So minimum till and no-till is another practice that is being recognized for carbon offset markets. Mm-hmm. So those are the two primary strategies, cover crops and conservation tillage or no-till are two strategies. Now, another one that we worked a lot on at Iowa State, and you may have run across some of the faculty that are working on this, a program led by Lisa Schulte Moore that looks at establishing additional perennial crops on the landscape in Iowa and strategically placing those so that they do the most environmental good that's possible. So if you think about grass strips strategically located along streams or on highly erodible land or mm-hmm. where a waterway comes down to a stream so that you've got this perennial cover that is sucking up carbon and providing additional environmental services. So those are some of the key things.
Yeah.
On our farm, we like to think that our pastures, so we have about 450 acres of pasture, that it greens up in March sometimes, and it sucks carbon out of the atmosphere through October a lot of times. So those pastures are perennial cover that we believe provide environmental benefits, but also carbon benefits.
Jill,
now,
yeah.
in the Jill, carbon trading market,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to, this is fascinating. You're explaining it so well. We only have 5 minutes left. I wanted to get some key questions after you
okay.
explained the practices, if you're finished up with that part.
Sure. Sure. Uh-huh.
One obvious question is how widespread are these practices right now? If we would look at maybe a pie chart, how much is this practice happening in Iowa across the country compared to what it could be in terms of carbon sequestration? Are we doing just a little bit and have a lot of potential, for instance?
I would say it's growing, but it has a long ways to go.
Okay.
So those of us that live in parts of the world where our soils, our topography is more sloping, we adopted conservation tillage and no-till and bought planters so that we can plant into no-till about 25 years ago. And that wasn't all that uncommon for people who have soil that their topography that's not flat. If you picture the Des Moines Lobe, which is about two-thirds of the state of Iowa, is fairly flat. It was covered by the last ice age and sort of flattened out. If you think about driving up around Mason City and north of Ames and so forth, that's part of the Des Moines Lobe. So those conservation no-till practices are not nearly as common in those areas of the state. Now, cover crops have gotten a lot of attention the last 5 to 8 years because of the environmental impacts on water quality. So the state of Iowa has done a lot of cost sharing, and we have seen a lot of uptake adoption of cover crops throughout the state of Iowa because there is that cost sharing available. We calculate that it costs us about $25 an acre to put cover crops out there. So, you know, you have to buy the seed, you have to plant them, you know, it's not an insignificant cost. In our case, we can graze those cover crops in the fall, and they provide significant feed for our cow herd for up to 2 months, and we can recapture some of that value of the cover crops, but not everybody has cows.
Right. In the final 2 minutes we have here, Jill, what will it take to encourage more farmers to take advantage of the practices you just described?
So continued development of the carbon markets, I think, is a real good opportunity to incentivize that. So right now the payments are not huge for this, but I think as more and more companies look at these offset markets, the payments will increase. And so it's a way for farmers to do the right thing environmentally and to increase their bottom line. So I think as these markets develop, we'll see more and more adoption.
Give us a sense of, for city dwellers especially, what's the spectrum of attitudes in rural Iowa among farmers about climate change at this point, having now experienced a number of extreme weather events here in Iowa, but also in the rest of the country and around the world? Are attitudes changing?
Very slowly, and it's somewhat along a political divide, right? So I like to talk to other farmers about climate. I don't use the word climate change. I just talk about the changes that you've noticed in your lifetime in the weather. Has the weather changed? And everybody says yes. Every farmer says, yeah, we didn't used to get 4-inch rains. We didn't used to get 5-inch rains. And so, yes, the weather has changed. And then you can say, well, what are you doing differently because of that? And they'll all talk about, well, they're put more tile in and so forth. So, you know, sometimes you have to pick your terms, but I don't think you'd be hard-pressed to find a farmer that would tell you the weather hasn't changed in their lifetime.
Climate change, there we go. There's a takeaway. Climate change in rural, among some rural farmers is a loaded word. Perhaps try to find a different way to explain it. Jill, we've run out of time. So fascinating. Such a good explanation of carbon sequestration and what you have happening. You're developing and have developed over quite some time in your and your husband's farm near Atlantic, handing it off to the next generation. So glad to hear that. Jill Yukin, also retired deputy director of the Iowa Bioeconomy Institute. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, how temperature change caused by, I'll just say it, climate change. I'll have to think about how I'm going to reword things now after that conversation with Jill. What it may mean to Iowa's historic prairie plants, that they perhaps will be unable to inhabit the future climate. Also, how to curb flooding caused by extreme weather events. That's all coming up as we talk about climate change here in Iowa. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer talking about how Iowa is already being impacted by changes in our weather, long-term climate changes, and how several organizations, Iowans, are taking action this half hour. We want to start off with David Stein. He's the watershed coordinator for Prairie Rivers of Iowa. That's a nonprofit organization in Boone County. David, welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you with us. Those who don't know about your organization, Prairie Rivers of Iowa, introduce us quickly to your nonprofit.
Yeah, so Prairie Rivers of Iowa is a fairly unique nonprofit here in central Iowa. We're mainly concerned about protecting natural resources in terms of water quality, in terms of wildlife, in terms of ecosystems, and even implementing practices on the farm, but we also work with cultural resources. And with that, we manage the Lincoln Highway Heritage Byway, which stretches all the way across the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so talk a little bit about the climate shift as you see it, so that we're getting more and more extreme weather events, the predictions are out there from climatologists. How would you characterize what's happening now and what's in front of us to the best of our ability to predict at this point?
Yeah, so what we are seeing, especially with the latest IPCC report, is that Iowa is getting warmer, and it will be having an increase in not only severe weather events, but also in precipitation as a whole. So something that we are predicting moving forward is Iowa will shift from a growing zone of 5, which covers pretty much the majority of the state, as well as southern Minnesota, but it will most likely move up to a growing zone of 6, which you can think of as Missouri and Kansas, or even in a worst case scenario, moving up to a growing zone of 7, which is currently found in Arkansas and Oklahoma. So we might have a shift in plants and ecosystems to kind of go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and how soon are those growing zone shifts to take place as far as we can tell, David?
Yeah, so it's looking like, according to the EPA, the growing zones, if climate action is not tackled immediately and aggressively, we could see it shift as soon as the end of the century. So it's, in a grand scheme of things, it's very, very soon. And it's a very, very rapid shift that we might be seeing in the near future.
Mm-hmm. And our planet has a very long life and has experienced different climates throughout that very long life. But this is a very rapid, dramatic change, relatively speaking. And you have been focused in part on our native prairies, which have, I don't know if you can give us a sense of how long our native prairie plants have been here to adapt to the climate we have currently.
Yes, so the prairie has been around here in the central part of the United States for millennia. This ecosystem was driven by years of grazing by large herbivores like bison for those thousands of years, as well as wildfires, either started through lightning strikes or other natural phenomena, or native people using it to clear out space for new bison to actually go and graze on, or just clearing out space for traveling. So this system not only has been here for millennia upon millennia, but it's been driven by those different factors for just as long. So we see this unique ecosystem here in Iowa, stretching down to Missouri and northern Minnesota and that type of region. And it's been here for quite a while, and this is a new threat that it's facing. Yeah. And it's really up to us to figure out what is going to happen and how things might change.
Right. Okay. So what can we do? Because these native plant species that you said have adapted here for millennia to the current climate, this is such a brief snapshot of time that they have. We would expect native plant species to die out because they cannot handle what is coming towards us in the coming decades?
Yeah, so there is a couple of different worries that not only we have, but that have been studied in multiple different studies. Just going off of temperature, we're really going to be worried about those plants that are on the southern edge of their range, things like the early blooming pasque flower, things like heartleaf goldenrod, and different hyssop species that really stretch down to Iowa as that edge of range. So as the planet warms, we're expecting those to eventually disappear from the Iowa landscape and try to find refuge up north. And on top of that, we are also predicting that more southern species will move in to take their place. On top of that, there's been studies showing that within the prairie itself, not only are we seeing shifts in species moving away from Iowa, but that heat will also affect the species currently around. We know that grasses can handle heat and drought a lot better than flowering plants can. Mm-hmm. So over repeated periods of that heat and over the repeated periods of drought, we're going to see grasses take up more space and kind of choke out or outcompete those wildflower species that just can't keep up.
In the few minutes we have remaining, tell us what needs to be done. What action are you taking with all of this in mind? What are your goals? What awareness needs to be raised? What can we do?
Yeah, so the best things that we can do are to preserve the natural areas or the natural prairie spots that we have left over in Iowa. We used to be covered by 80% of the entire state in prairie, but now it's been reduced down to less than 1%. So conserving and saving seeds and conserving that biodiversity and what we have left over is really, really important. Moving forward, we also need to make sure that our prairies are well-maintained. So a well-maintained prairie will increase the prairie's health, the health of the individual plants, and can help those species weather some of these climate shifts and weather some of these extreme droughts and extreme rainfall events. So having a well-maintained prairie will help boost its health. And finally, I would encourage anyone with land that they are willing to convert over into to start adding more prairie onto some of the lands that they're not using. That prairie will, as we learned from the last speaker, sequester some of that carbon and start bringing down some of those emissions and hopefully get us to a net zero as quickly as possible. So really, that's what I would encourage in the short term.
Okay, very good. So what action can be taken by regular people living in cities, living in rural areas? In closing, David Stein.
Yep. So a good thing to do is just get educated and know what you are up against. So knowing that you rely on some of these ecosystems for biodiversity and for climate action, bring some of those up to your local representatives, your federal representatives, really anyone who is willing to lend an ear, especially if you are in the city or might not have land of your own. Talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to farmers that you might know who have that extra space that might be more available to prairie rather than crops. Really getting as much on the landscape as possible and securing the ones that we do have will help us in the long run.
Very good. David Stein, Watershed Coordinator for Prairie Rivers of Iowa, a nonprofit organization in Boone County. Thank you, David, for explaining your mission and what you have facing you.
Yep. Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News this hour, how Iowa is being impacted by the changing climate, how some Iowans are taking action. Let's finish up with John Rathbun. He's Clear Creek Watershed Coordinator, which covers Johnson and Iowa counties for the Iowa Watershed Approach. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the watershed you're responsible for.
Sure. The Clear Creek Watershed is the smallest of the eight watersheds that are in the Iowa Watershed Approach. We're about 66,000 acres. And we start out north of Williamsburg and run east through Oxford and Tiffin, and it meets up with the Iowa River in Coralville.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
About the makeup, there. As far as land use and land cover in 2017, about 60% is row crop, meaning either corn or soybeans or some other annual crop. About 17% is urban, and that would be Tiffin, Coralville, parts of North Liberty, a little bit of Iowa City, and Oxford. And then 15% is grassland or hay and alfalfa. That's a brief overview on what's going on as far as plantings and such are concerned.
Give us a little history, recent history, of how this watershed has experienced flooding.
Yeah, we've had a number of historic flooding events. Most of the records that I have access to start in the 50s. We've had six flash flood events since 1962. The most recent being in 2013. Many people that live in the Coralville area may remember that real heavy rainstorm we had. A little more historically, and David spoke a little bit about this. I've got a chart that shows annual precipitation in the watershed from 1900 to 2000 and looks like 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. And from 1900 to 1960, we had just 2 years that were above 45 inches in rainfall. Our average is 37 inches, roughly. And since 1960, we've had 5 years where the precipitation was over 45 inches.
And what does that tell you, John?
It's getting wetter. And if you look at the chart, these wet years correlate pretty closely with our flooding events. The early 90s, so 1993, 2008, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the other factors that contribute to flooding events, these downpours. I guess we've changed the landscape.
We have. Iowa's one of the most changed landscape in the United States, if not even a greater area. Through farming and also urbanization, both areas have contributed to this. But changing from prairie, which is deep rooted and year round, which soaks in rainwater real well, to farmland and paved areas in the case of an urban situation, we've increased the runoff from maybe, I think it was, I don't have that slide in front of me, used to be maybe 10 to 20% of the water ran off of the landscape, to now it's over 50, sometimes 60, 70% of the rainwater runs off directly into the streams.
Mm-hmm. Combination of the extreme weather becoming more present and also the change of our landscape. Okay, given that picture in the minutes we have remaining, let's dig into some mitigation practices. How can we combat this, work against this, so that the floods, whatever comes down in terms of inches per hour, we can better deal with?
Yeah, so the Iowa watershed approach is focused on flooding first. So what we try to do is get distributed storage up in the watershed. So if you think about eggs in baskets, we're putting eggs in many baskets instead of one big basket. So we've got multiple ponds that are either have been constructed or going to be constructed throughout the watershed to help hold back that rainwater in large events. The other thing that people can do to help soak water into the ground is much like Jill was talking about with no-till and cover crops, which makes the soil structure better and actually more porous so that water can get into the ground and soak into the ground quicker. So that combined with the distributed storage can make a huge difference, I think, and kind of mimic what we used to have with the prairies. We'll never, of course, get back to what we used to have, but if we can get to a point where we soak more water in than we are running off, we'll be in much better shape.
Mm-hmm. Water sediment and these control basins, I guess some people call them dry ponds, are you building those? So what are they and how do they work in this context?
The dry ponds?
Yes.
Okay, so essentially a dry pond, some people might think of that as like a detention basin in an urban setting. In the rural setting, it can be large, where it's essentially just like a pond structure where you've got a dam, but the outlet for the dam is in the bottom. So it fills up when it rains hard and then slowly drains down over the next 24 to 48 hours. And then there's a structure called a water and sediment control basin, which is on a smaller scale, which the structure is not like a dam, but it's similar in the sense that it stops water and holds it in place for 12, 24, 48 hours and helps the sediment settle out and also keeps the water out of the stream a little bit longer.
Are they effective, and these other measures effective, as effective when you have a long term, like a heavy, a constant rain over a few days compared to a heavy rain over a short period that might have flash flooding? Does it mitigate both types of precipitation?
Yeah, I think they do. I think that their most effectiveness, you'll notice, would be in the heavier rainstorms. Mm-hmm. But lighter rains over a long period of time can really produce a similar circumstance downstream. So I think they're effective in both of those situations.
Mm-hmm. And those, how many of those have been built in your district and are more being built?
Yeah, so far let me turn to that page. So far, we've built 34 structures, and we've got 18 more coming up shortly. When we're done, we should have close to 70 practices. And of the finished practices, once we're all completed, we'll have about 15 ponds, 3 dry ponds, 16 water and sediment control basins, 6 small wetlands, and 4 floodplain reconnections. And these smaller wetlands don't hold back a lot of water, but they hold back some water. And mm-hmm. the floodplain reconnection is similar in that respect, that a lot of people will notice that creeks and streams in Iowa are way down below the surrounding land. We call that incised. And that's because of the flashiness of our system now. So we'll get a lot of erosion and down cutting of the stream. And if we can reconnect that stream to some portion of a floodplain, that'll help store water and some sediment as well.
In the final minute or two, let's talk about the other extreme drought, which much of Iowa is experiencing right now. I had a look at the Iowa drought map today. Of course, your area not experiencing the worst of it in the state, the worst in the northern part of the state. What do you have to say about drought and how we deal with that now and in the future?
Yeah, I think back to Jill's point of no-till and cover crop, it helps create a resilient soil, so that can help hold water longer. As far as the projects that we're funding, a lot of our ponds are being used for livestock watering as well. Of course, if they're dry, they don't help with that. But I think if we take a big picture view and look at soil health as a way to recharge our underground water and aquifers and also help keep our water in the soil as long as possible, we're much to the benefit.
Mm-hmm. John, in closing, how optimistic are you about the future in the goals you have for your watershed in Clear Creek, considering the best predictions we have for what we face in the future?
I'm optimistic. We've done, I think, about 23% of the work in really less than 4 years that our studies have shown will help knock off the top of heavy rainstorms. And if we can continue to build those projects, we'll have a good handle on it. I think also people do better when they know better. So getting education out there and having personal experiences relatable to other people is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. How much of it depends on how well we mitigate the carbon that we're putting in the air, put the brakes on this massive climate change, which is surprising in its acceleration and surprising to even earlier predictions that it's going faster than we thought.
Yeah, I think we really have to take that very seriously. One of the callers that you guys had on last week, when you had the climatologist and agronomist on, talked about resistance to changing practices, a risk aversion, and much like David was talking about, if our climate zones change, there's a pretty serious risk involved with that. So the more we can do now, the better. And it's difficult because it's a future problem that we're trying to deal with today. So we just have to keep talking about it and keep working toward it as best we can. And everybody can help out.
Right. John Rathbun, Clear Creek Watershed Coordinator. John, thank you for your view this hour.
Thank you, Ben. Glad to be here.
How Iowa is being impacted by climate change, how Iowans are taking action. If you'd like to check out a podcast, perhaps you heard only part of this program, go to iowapublicradio.org to find all of our talk shows as podcasts. Tomorrow on the program, it's a News Buzz edition. We'll explore how the education secretary is exploring possible legal action against states, including Iowa, that have blocked school mask mandates. That and other news when we have our News Buzz tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.